Welcome to Season 5 of the Unscripted Medicine Podcast, a podcast created and produced by medical students at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine.
On the show, we explore ideas in medicine you can't always find in a textbook. From navigating medical education to exploring humanism in medicine and developing our physician identities, we hope there's something for everyone.
Check out the show notes or our website for more information, helpful links, resources, and more.
Please connect with us via email, on Instagram, or on Twitter at unscripted_med. We would love to hear from you. We hope you enjoy.
Hello, and welcome back to another recording of the Unscripted Medicine Podcast. I'm Molly, and I'm joined with my co-host, Andrew. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Molly.
And today we are interviewing Dr. Eric Worm about the topic of normalized deviance. Hi, Dr. Worm.
Hi, Molly. Hi, Andrew.
How are you doing today?
Very well. Thank you.
Good. Well, if you don't mind giving us a little introduction about yourself.
Yeah, my name is Eric. I am a primary care physician. I graduated from the same medical school that you're going to right now a long time ago. And currently I'm serving as the program director of internal medicine and the vice chair of education for the Department of Medicine here in Cincinnati.
Thank you. And then how did you become interested in the topic of normalized deviance and kind of what is it?
That's a great question. I think I got there because I got into quality improvement many years ago. So if you're faced with a problem and you aren't skilled in how to solve the problem, it's often frustrating. And I was lucky enough to fall into a group of people who were really systematically trying to solve problems. It was 2006. It was called the Academic Chronic Care Collaborative. And what this group did was gave us a framework for how to look at complex problems and understand why they occur. If you're familiar with the model for improvement, the first question from that model is, what is the problem we're trying to solve? What is the nature of the problem that we're facing? And as I was deep in that work, I had a friend of mine introduce me to this concept of normalized deviance. So normalized deviance is a concept that was put together by a person named Diane Vaughan when she analyzed the Space Shuttle Challenger's disaster in 1986. And I can tell you the story of the Challenger in a minute, but just to frame up what normalized deviance is, it's defined as organizational behaviors that deviate from normative standards or professional expectations. Where outside people see the situation as deviant, where inside people get accustomed to it, seeing it as routine, rational, or entirely acceptable. So the key there is that when you're in it, you don't even think it's deviant. But anyone from the outside would say, oh, That's weird. I can't believe that's happening. And once you get this idea in your head, there are many examples of normalized deviance that you see all over the world, including in medical education or medical care in general.
And I know you mentioned the Challenger. Do you mind kind of diving into that example for us?
Yeah, I think I first came wind of this when I heard a guy named Bob Ebeling. He was an engineer for the Challenger, and he was on NPR, and he had this quote. I'll just read it to you. So the thing about Bob is that he knew the Space Shuttle Challenger was going to blow up, and yet he couldn't stop it. Or he knew there was a risk it was going to blow up, and he couldn't stop it. And I remember I was in college when this happened, and I remember watching the news in a much slower news cycle than there was in 1986 compared to now, in which they had already figured out by the time I'd gotten home that it was probably the O-ring. I was like, how? In retrospect, now I understand what that meant. So here's the story of Bob. He said this before he died. I think this is one of the mistakes that God made. He shouldn't have picked me for the job. I don't know, but the next time I talk to him, I'm going to ask him why you picked the loser. So he went to the grave thinking that somehow he was responsible or bore this huge responsibility for the failure of the Challenger, when in fact, there were many, many failures, the failures of normalized deviance that led to this problem. So you have to understand what was happening back in 1986. It was January. The Challenger was on the launch pad, and it was really cold, and much colder than they really wanted it. The weather was, I think, clear but cold, and so they had delayed the launch days after days because it was just so cold. And why does cold matter? It's because there's these things called O-rings that go around the booster rocket that kind of seal the O-rings, and they were 38 feet in circumference and a quarter inch thick. So you can imagine this rubber thing going around two pieces of machinery full of gas and energy. And the fear was that as it got colder, the O-rings would shrink and gases would escape and that could get ignited, and then that could blow up the Challenger. And It had never been tested below 53 degrees, and here we are in the 20s in January in Florida. And so the engineers were like, don't go, don't go. Well, eventually, as you know, they went. And if you see a picture of the Challenger, they didn't see it in real time, but within 1 second, less than 1 second, you could see gases escaping from the, what's called the O-ring blowby. And then by 73 seconds, it had ignited and blown up. And so the question is, how did the engineers know that this could happen? And yet a launch go was put into effect by the launch, the people who said go. And that's what this woman, Diane Vaughn, worked out geniusly in her many papers and books and coined the term normalized deviance and worked out the steps. So that's the story of the Challenger in a brief moment. And as we get into it later, we can go through some classic examples of normalized deviance that you may have seen in your real life that isn't medicine, and of course the ones in medicine. But they all work through the same mechanisms.
Thank you for kind of giving us that prime example. I know that was something that I learned about in college. Was in my tech ethics class, we kind of went through the Challenger and the O-ring failure, but also, you know, the normalized deviance behind it. So it was cool to hear you give this talk when I was on my internal medicine rotation. It really felt like some of my undergrad teaching came full circle and applied in more of a medical education context. And then Andrew, I know you're joining us today, and you've experienced kind of in the military. Do you have any specific examples? Or I know like normalized deviance is something that applies there as well.
Yeah. It's kind of weird because I see a lot of kind of similarities between medicine, transitioning from the military to medicine. I can see a lot of similarities between just the hierarchical structure just within education, at least specifically in terms of students and residents and attendings and how that kind of education format looks and the challenges and kind of the fear of having to speak up when you do identify issues. And so it's kind of, in my experience, it was kind of similar in the military where it was a very rigid hierarchical structure. And I guess one example that I have was within my first few years in the Army. I was a very young officer and I showed up to my first unit, and in the first few days there was another officer who was senior to me in time. He had been there longer, but same rank. And there was some memorandum that he needed signed by our company commander at the time, and it was something really minuscule that was just part of the normal Army bureaucracy. But he said, hey, like, will you sign this for the commander? And as a new, you know, lieutenant, I just kind of didn't know what to do. And I was clearly very uncomfortable with it. And there were multiple other people in the room who, you know, didn't see any problems with this. And I just kind of froze and was so uncomfortable with it that he was just like, never mind. And he just did it himself and sent it off on its way. And I mean, maybe this is normalized deviance, me saying this right now, but that memorandum was not going to have any bearing on anybody or anything, right? It was just a piece of paper that needed to be signed and just go to keep things moving along. And that's definitely normalized deviance, what I'm explaining right there, right?
Can I make a point just to follow that? So yeah. To be clear, hierarchy in itself is not necessarily bad, and even rigidity. Mm-hmm. What is it? If hierarchy and rigidity lead to normalized deviance, which we haven't really got into the components of it, and it produces something bad, then it becomes deviant. Mm-hmm. Whereas those things might produce good things depending on how you organize yourself. So I've never been in the military, but if the military is doing well and things are good and no one's getting hurt by it and hierarchy is good because it's not causing harm, then it's not normalized deviance. It becomes normalized deviance mm-hmm. when harm is occurring again and again and no one is speaking up, or you can't speak truth to power because power can't see the truth that you're speaking.
So does harm need to occur for it to be normalized deviance? If it's something, because in the case of the Challenger explosion, I mean, they use those same O-rings multiple times, and maybe someone identified this problem previously and nothing happened.
Well, that actually is the very first step of normalized deviance, which is what's called the illusion of invulnerability, which basically says when the engineers, who were the Bob Eblings of the world, raised the possibility of O-ring blowby, then the launch people said, well, that was true of every other flight we've ever had. But in quality improvement, just because something hasn't happened doesn't mean it won't. And so we often talk about waiting for harm, but in quality improvement, you have this concept of the near miss. It's just as bad as harm. You just got lucky. And if you don't, if you parse those to separate, you get into trouble. So a good quality improver would say, just because harm didn't happen doesn't mean it won't, and we should take it serious. That's the first step of the eight steps of normalized deviance. So I don't know if that counts in the conversation you just had. If there was potential harm, but it wasn't realized, then you just got lucky. You still have to pay attention.
Right, and I could see how the example that Andrew gave too is like a slippery slope potentially to leading to signing larger and like more important things that eventually could lead to more harm. But like you said, that one necessarily wasn't maybe the most important memorandum. But I guess that leads me to my next question. Like, why does normalized deviance typically occur?
So yeah, the eight steps that Diane Vaughn worked out. So the first one is that one I just mentioned, the illusion of invulnerability, the idea that it's never happened before and you assume that it won't happen again. The second is that it's a group problem. It's a groupthink problem. And so the second step is belief in the inherent morality of the group, where the person making decisions is right and the person bringing the problem up is wrong. And what the engineer says, I had the distinct feeling that we were in the position of having to prove it was unsafe instead of the other way around. Those in the position of power need to listen to those who might not have the power but have the knowledge. But if you think because you have power, you're right, you could be in trouble. The third step is what's called the collective rationalization. Now, this is a groupthink problem where the engineer said, you know, we were counting on the secondary O-ring to be the sealing O-ring under the worst case conditions. And so if you begin in aviation, I'm not an aviator, but I know they have like critical things that have to be right and you have backups, but you don't count on the backup. You don't say, well, the backup will catch it. You have them, but you're like, no, I need. And so if you start saying to yourself, well, maybe the O-rings will catch the problem. So collective rationalization is a third thing. And then you start to get what humans do to each other. We are in-group, out-group people. Love to talk to you about a different topic. I gave grand rounds on this earlier this year on in-group and out-group manifestations in hospitals. But you begin to get what's called out-group stereotypes. When the lead launch people say to the engineers, hey, when do you want me to launch, next April? Like, you're against me instead of we're not in it together and you're causing me a problem. Mm-hmm. And then step five is you put direct pressure on dissenters. Take off your engineering hat and put on your management hat. Like, you got to worry about my problems and I don't have to worry about your problems. And then what happens is when you get beat on so much, you yourself begin to self-censor. That's the sixth step. So in this case, the self-censorship was a no-go recommendation below 53 degrees became, quote, lower temperatures or in the direction of badness for O-rings. Because you're tired of getting, you know, pushed down by the leaders, right? You're like, well, okay, I'll soften my language so I don't have to, like, defend so hard. And then step seven is called self-appointed mind guards. Subject matters are excluded from decision briefs. So after a while, the engineers who are the problem people don't get to be in the room to have the conversation. And then step eight, the final step that seals the deal, that is the illusion of unanimity because silence is interpreted as agreement. Well, they're not talking up, so we must be right. So those are the eight steps, and it happens because this is what humans do. We just organize around principles that lead us down these bad paths. But what happens in normalized deviance, when you join a group and they're doing it abnormally, initially you might think, oh, I feel uncomfortable here. I don't like this. And then after a while, it is the thing that you do. I give that lecture to you as third years because I want you to still see what you can see when you were third year medical students. You walk on the wards, you're instantly uncomfortable because we're not treating people like the way you thought about when you wrote your personal statement to get into medical school. And my line to you that I give you is, why do third year students feel this way, but third year residents do not? That's normalized deviance writ large, that you lose whatever part of humanity that makes you feel uncomfortable when you see bad things. You lose it. And I think the only way to get out of a normalized deviance, there's only two ways. Either you have a sentinel event, something terrible happens, like the thing blows up, or you make the problem visible. What's interesting in medicine is we've had tons of sentinel events and tons of visibility, and it hasn't changed. It's a really interesting problem. In military, I don't know. It's all written down. I'm sure there is rules, but in medicine, it's sort of all in the hidden curriculum. You just learn to be the way you see when you come onto the wards.
Yeah, so I guess how do we go about addressing that as students? You know, if you're trying to empower us in, you know, this opening lecture, and you're trying to empower students to identify that deviance, how do we go about doing that?
Yeah, so you have to keep the problem visible for you. And this, what's interesting is that as a university lecturer, I talked to lots of students over the years, and this one presentation has made more students angry than any other one I have ever given. Because I think people,
really?
Yes, people get so mad because they've come on to this service or whatever it is. They've come into medicine with high hopes and whatever you thought it was going to be like. And then it's different and it's not always good. And you have to subjugate yourself to this. And I say that it's a problem. And then I put it on you. And I say, you have to keep visible so that when you get into power, you can actually connect truth to power. So, but that's, I think, the only way, because many of us cannot see anymore what we cannot see. It's the unknown box that people talk about. So I'm hoping by talking about this with people that you'll be able to recognize normalized deviance for what it is, speak that, other people will see that with you. So let me give you a classic example that I guess, Andrew, you haven't gone through yet, but Molly has.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get honors in medicine in a world in which it's not pass-fail? How do you get honors? On the wards, you show off. Mm-hmm. How do you show off? You walk on the wards and you show only your strengths. Look at me, I'm good at these things, look at me. Nobody ever walks in the wards and says to their attending, I'm really bad at these 17 things. And so what ends up happening is that you begin to hide your weaknesses so you don't get found out, so you can get honors, so you can get a grade. Now, completely deviant, right? That's terrible. What patient would want you to do that? If you called your mother up and said, what I do all day in third year is I hide all my weaknesses so nobody finds me out, she would be aghast, I would hope, right?
Right.
Yeah. And yet, right. Molly entered that day world, you know, a year ago. And that's, I don't know if you've been doing that or felt that way, Molly, but many people do.
I was going to say, shout out to the CVME pathway, because I think that the competency base has given me space to show my weaknesses in a way that doesn't affect, you know, that honors grade. But I see it directly in that comparison.
So that's brilliant that you joined that pathway. So for your listeners, I don't know if you talked about this pathway, but one of my academic partners is leading that. His name is Matt Kelleher. So if we set up the incentives to get honors, you have to act this way. And the reason you have to get honors is because you won't get the residency of your choice, and that ruins your life. We're going to get the behavior that leads to normalized deviance, right? Because the risks are too high. So what Matt has decided to do is a pilot project where we incent the different things. We're not going to give you a grade. We're going to say, here's the criterion. Be at the criterion. There'll be no comparison above the criterion. Nobody will be best or better than you. You'll just be good enough, and good enough is important. And when you do that, then the incentives flip. And in order to be good enough, you have to show all your weaknesses so you can get there. The risk that Molly is taking, though, is that residency programs may look at that as a negative. Now, personally, I would think that I would take that as a positive, because I'm all into that, because that flips the incentives in the right way. And kills the normalized deviance of this particular issue, for sure.
No, and I appreciate being on that pathway for that exact reason every day, because I feel, even today, I'm able to say, hey, these are my goals for the day. I'm really bad at these things, and I know I'm going to struggle through it, but I'm able to get that like feedback and support that I need for things to grow. So hopefully little changes like this can help combat normalized deviance. And then I know we talked about, you know, this example. Do you have any other like classic examples that you've seen in your quality improvement work or anything like that in terms of healthcare?
Well, let's talk about some classic examples from the world, so people who might not really have gotten this concept will understand. So a classic case of normalized deviance was in 2008 with the Wall Street meltdown. If you think about all the traders, they were creating these really complex derivatives that were betting on you to lose, but they were so complex that no one could understand them. And it was perverse because you had to lose for them to win, but they were hoping for you to lose. Now, completely deviant from the outside, but on the inside, it was like, this is what we do at this trading house. This is how it is. The Wells Fargo meltdown of a couple years ago. So they were incenting their employees to open up a lot of accounts. John Stumpf says, it's great if you could get to 8 or something like that. I paraphrase that. So what they would do is that you would call up Wells Fargo and you make an account, and then they would try to sell you the other accounts. And if you didn't agree, when you hung up, they took your information, which they now had, and they would open up accounts in your name, not tell you that, get credit for the accounts, and you know, something bad would happen to your credit, I would guess. And that got all found out. Now, completely deviant from what we were seeing. But on the inside, it was like, well, this is what we do here. We do this. And it became the culture. It's classic normalized deviance. And there are other, there are many, if you just Google that, and you'll find tons of examples. In medicine, I think that the things that we do that are deviant, that lead to harm, one, for sure for students, the grading schema and all of the things I just talked about, where students are not allowed to share what they're most fearful of for fear of it affecting their grade is normalized deviance. Another thing is, think about, did you know that the average doctor spends about 7 minutes a day at bedside with a given patient? The patient's admitted for 24 hours and they get 7 minutes of your face. We spend 40% of our time on a computer. That's sort of what we do. Is that what you went to medical school for? Is that what patients want? And yet we just reproduce that day after day after day.
Do you have an example of something that did not start out as deviant, but is now considered deviant and vice versa?
Well, that's a hard question, because in every one of these cases, it started out innocently enough, right? Mm-hmm. They didn't go right to complex derivatives. We didn't go right to having to hide your weaknesses. We got there incrementally. And so I would think that all these things started that way. No one sets out to be malicious or bad. These aren't bad actors. These are just people responding to incentives with the overlay of human behavior, where we all try to give the advantage and are looking at our own needs and not broadly to others. But I think it's not as simple as that. I think they all start that way.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned before that this is one of the lectures that you get a lot of pushback from students on. So given that, and then given the context of normalized deviance kind of taking over the culture, what would you say to an individual that asks you, like, why should I care? Like, why should I care about normalized deviance? And, like, if there's, it's a cultural thing and I can't do anything about it.
Yeah, I think what angered the students so much before I altered the way I presented it was when I said you have to speak truth to power, they said, as soon as I do that, that affects my grade. So you're telling me that I'm the only one that can solve this problem because I'm still the only one with the vision to see the deviance, and you're giving me this and burdening me with the risk to my own grade. What kind of person are you? Or they would say to me, so you're saying that I'm both the victim and I have to be the savior here. What are you doing to solve the problem? And so now I think what a version you saw, Molly, I'm sure that I softened that by saying, look, like, this isn't just on you. People like Matt Keller, who are actually trying to solve a problem, there are many people out there trying to solve it. But we all become blind to our unknown unknowns. And so I do think that the central message is, if you want to step from your system one to your system two thinking and say, am I doing something here that is causing harm repeatedly that I might not be able to see? Only when you ask yourself that question will you be able to see it. Unless someone like me or you says, hey, can you see this thing? But we don't often run into people like that. Mm-hmm. And I know that, not saying that I'm perfect, there are probably things that I'm doing right now that have harm attached to them that I don't see. And I need to have that be pointed out to me. So I guess, Andrew, to answer your question, number one, make the problem visible for yourself and others. This is the thing. And then be humble when somebody points out to something that you're doing. Instead of saying no, say, let me consider that, at least is the first step. I think a lot of people don't do that. Mm-hmm. And then get help. You can't solve a big problem by yourself. It's just not possible.
Have you seen examples of normalized deviance be addressed and changed systematically?
For sure.
Because a lot of the examples you give, I mean, the normalized deviance that you're seeing in students where we hide our weaknesses is because we're entering an institution where that is, like you said, those are the incentives. I mean, I can't change the institution and I have to, I mean, I don't have to, right?
Well, Andrew, I think you can change the institution, not as a second or third year medical student, I can't say that's an absolute. People can organize. So let's just talk about that. So Matt is changing something. He was an intern just a few years ago. If you think about my own program, I'll give you two small examples of something that we do here that I feel strongly about that was different in the past. So the first is we talked about bedside rounding. So we spend the majority of our time at the bedside on our bedside rounding teams, where all the work is done at the bedside. It's visible, open, transparent, if we do it right. That has been a huge change, and it's been about 10 years to work that out. We're not perfect at it, but a second might be what we do in academic half day. The mantra of half day is we don't actually care what you know when you enter half day. We're after what you don't know, because that's where the learning is. And in the educational parlance, that's known as the zone of proximal development. Well, guess what's uncomfortable in the zone of proximal development? Being asked questions you don't know in front of people who might be in charge of saying you're going to graduate. And so we try to flip that on its head and say, this is the purpose of being here, is that we're going to go where you need to go to learn, and we will not judge you on the way to learning. So come, let's go. You know, the first question is only to get to the space where you don't know the answer, but we're not going to cause what's called toxic quizzing. Well, my friend Ben and I wrote a paper on this. It used to be known as pimping, but we got rid of that. That's a word. In fact, that's another part of normalized deviance, right? Language is so important. So the term pimp, to pimp a medical student meant to rapid fire ask them questions, not for their knowledge, but for your satisfaction of being smarter. Now, that term pimp itself, it has a huge negative connotation. And so we can take those words and say we're not going to use them anymore and get out of it. We'll make that visible, and we'll call it something else. We call it toxic quizzing now. So both in the example of the language that we use, and actually the thing that we do, when I ask you questions is not to judge you, it's not to show what I know, it's to figure out what you don't know and help you get from point A to point B. Those are all examples of changing behavior that, when I entered medical school in 1989, was just part of the life that we had, that I hope that you are not experiencing anymore. I don't know, Molly, you're out there and seeing these things.
Well, I was going to say, it's hard to find that balance, because one person might experience something as toxic quizzing because of the headspace that they're in for that day, or maybe something else that has happened, whereas maybe the resident or attending or whoever's above them, like asking them questions, is trying to, like you said, find that line of the information that they feel comfortable with and where to teach. But might the delivery might be more like toxic quizzing than like a more helpful quizzing. So it's a fine line, and I can appreciate both. And I think it kind of, I don't know, it's hard to figure out exactly where that stands. And I think it's very like individually dependent.
All right, well then, that's an excellent point. But we're in now the unknown box. So if I'm delivering messaging to you that makes you feel bad, and I consistently do this, mm-hmm. and yet you never give me feedback because you don't feel safe enough to give me that feedback, well, there you have it, right? There's another concept that's sort of related to what we're talking about called psychological safety. Amy Edmondson is the person who originated this sort of research line. Go look up her research, it's amazing. But psychological safety is that you feel the space is safe for interpersonal risk-taking. It doesn't mean it is safe. It means you feel it's safe enough to say, hey, when you asked me that question that way, here's how I felt. But we almost never do that in medicine. Why would that be, right? So that's right there an overlay of what could be normalized deviance.
And I think from my perspective as someone on the CBME pathway, not to, you know, make the whole episode about it, but I think that I have a higher, I don't know if tolerance is right, but I feel there's a safer space in general. So even if I'm asked the same questions, I don't feel as much pressure that I have to get it right. So it might not be on the person asking the questions necessarily, but it also might not be on my peers. But yeah, I think it's an interesting space to be in. And somehow, and I can see where it's helpful because, you know, when someone's, Andrew, I'm sure you've experienced this in the first 2 years too, but when they're explaining something at a level that you already understand, it's not the best use of everyone's time, because you could be pushing yourself further, but finding that balance is difficult. So yeah, I don't know. I appreciate that perspective as well.
In the old days, people would do terrible things because one part of the medical education normalized deviance is that we grade you on a curve, not a curve, we normalize, we put a normative comparisons. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be an honors and a high pass and a pass, right? And that will translate to your class rank, which then translates to your desirability for some residency. And so when we put medical students in competitive positions against each other, then the point is not learning. The point is do better than the other guy. And on a ward team in which you have three mm-hmm. medical students and one of them is behind, what do the other two medical students do? Do they lift that person up? Are they glad it's not them? Or do they actively kind of push that person even farther down? You're going to see all those behaviors, right? And in my day, before the internet, this is true. People would check out a book from the library so no one else could get it. So they would be the only person with the knowledge, right?
Well.
That doesn't happen anymore. But those behaviors occur because we've created these incentives that are deviant and create harm. When it's not about learning, but it's about saving face, we're doing it wrong. So in any situation in which embarrassment keeps you from raising your hand, think about that. Mm-hmm. Look at that. Look at that environment and go, is this the way it should be? Because what would be worse, raising your hand and getting it wrong, or taking your ignorance into the next moment because you didn't fix it? And many people choose that second one. That's deviant, and it's normalized.
Mm-hmm. I'm kind of grappling with this concept because, you know, like you said, part of it is on the individual to speak up and identify that deviance. But there's a second part of that too, is whether or not you mean to, Dr. Worm, right? Whether or not you even know that you're doing things that are harmful to others is creating how do you create a space where people feel comfortable speaking up to do that? And I guess my question is, do we, Molly, in your experience, is there space in the institution of third year and medical school so far for students to even speak up safely? Do you think that the institution is actually creating that space for that discussion?
So there's, at the end of each course, you can submit an anonymous course eval where you can report mistreatment. I will say I've been fortunate enough not to have to follow up with, like I haven't had to submit something that then I would need follow up with. So I'm not sure how well or how often the necessary steps, I guess, would be taken from something like that. But at least there is that's a space. Today, for like a personal example today was, I feel like you often hear of the medical student who experiences a really traumatic thing. So I'm on my emergency medicine rotation, and we had a younger man die today after receiving, like, we were able to achieve, like, ROSC, like, circulation, and then he coded again and ended up passing. And you often hear about, like, the third-year medical student experiencing all these things and the team just moving on and not taking any, like, care for the student and how that might have impacted them, or because that's a really big deal. But these residents and attending see it day in and day out. But I will say I had a really great resident that was able to make sure that I was okay, and that, like, he pulled me aside and just, like, asked how I was doing and what thoughts I had. And I was also, like, included in the family discussion, which I thought was really, like, impactful, and I was glad to be able to be there for the family and see, you know, how we're able to support them in this time of need. But so I guess that's my example of someone, like, a safe space to talk about these things, and then also someone kind of breaking the normalized deviance chain that I've heard about in other spheres or other people's experiences. So I don't know if that fully answers your question, but there are some spaces, but they can be limited.
To the point that both you've made, Andrew, and Molly, you've made, that people come differently and you might be one way and there's a thousand ways. It's absolutely true that humans are so interesting and nuanced, and when you're with somebody, you can't assume how they are going to be. So a great educator, in my opinion, is flexible. I always use the metaphor of the ankle. You don't have ultimate, like, range of motion, but if you weren't able to flex around the rocks on the beach, you'd fall over. And I think the same thing should be what happens when we're with you. I'm guessing that, Molly, you're different than Andrew. So when I'm with you, I should spend a little time getting to know you and adapting what I know and can do to what you know and need. And when we don't do that, when we one size fits all you or expect you to figure it out, I think that, I don't know if that's normalized deviance, but it's not ideal in my opinion. And I think this is a really important topic that we think about in education. Is, am I a teacher or a facilitator of learning? Because a teacher, I do my thing, you like me or you don't like me, and then the rest is on you, I think. But a facilitator of learning, it doesn't sound good like teacher, so we don't say that. But I'm here to move you or help you move you from point A to point B. Imagine if every educator came and said, okay, who are you? Where are you? I have the skills to help you, and if I can't, I'll get you the right person, and I'm here for you. Imagine if we oriented around that. A lot of times in education, though, I do my thing, you do your thing, we're disconnected, or actually you're here to serve me as the educator, especially in the clinical environment, and it doesn't feel so good. All those things go unsaid and unseen in the hidden curriculum, And I don't know if that's normalized deviance, but it certainly is hidden and impactful.
And I think one of the biggest things that I always say is when I'm working with a new team, not that like they need to get to know me on a super personal level, but I always can tell if I'm asked, oh, what do you want to do with your life? Or like a question like that, there is going to be a safer space for learning because they've already opened that door about trying to get to know me in some way, shape or form. Whereas if I don't, I know things are fast paced, so it's not, you know, always true. But if that's not a question that's asked or something along those lines, it's not always the best educational experience. And I don't know if it's just because it makes me feel more comfortable or they are, you know, trying to get that baseline level of understanding of where I'm coming from too. But that's just like a quick thing that I've noticed throughout my third year as well.
Great question to be asked. Here's a great question you could ask next time. Molly, you're going to be an AI in less than a few months, and then mm-hmm. and then a senior, and you're going to be a resident, and then you're going to be an attending. It's going to be so fast. Andrew will be just behind you. When you're in charge of a team, if you want to create a safe space, here's a question you might say. On the very first day, at the end of the first day together, simply ask, how did it go today? What could I do better? What could we do better? If every attending asked that question on the first day and really meant and listened, and it'd be such a different place, because then you're like, well, I can speak up now because they asked me how it's going. And mm-hmm. I think every team that I'm on where I ask that question early, it's a much better team than if I assume that they're just going to talk to me and they don't know. They don't know I'm open, or maybe they assume I'm the opposite. I don't know, because we didn't get it out in the open. So I should be asking who you are, and then I should be inviting you, if I'm the leader, to speak up in ways that I'll listen. And then when you do tell me that something was broken or I did something wrong, I can't deny it, I can't deflect it. I have to say thank you for the feedback. That's all complex and difficult, and it's easy to say in a podcast and hard to do when you have to see 15 patients and do a million things. But those are some ways to create a safe space that I hope you figure out for yourself. Because it would be terrible if here you are, these people thinking about this, and then 4 years from now, you're not people creating those spaces for others. Wouldn't that be terrible?
Certainly hope that's not true. Yeah. But you're right. I mean, with normalized deviance, it's you go down that pathway and eventually you are in the unknown unknown. So hopefully we can combat it by having these conversations often. And you kind of just answered another question we had for you, but have you noticed any other changes in your like leadership style or how you practice medicine that you have like employed since kind of diving into the topic of normalized deviance?
It's hard. It's all like a big lasagna where it all goes in there and you bite the thing and you're like, oh, it's all in there. So I don't know that I can say for sure. But I think what I have, now I'm old, and I have some things I didn't have when I was younger. You know what Socrates said? He said when he got old and was about to die, he said the only thing he knows is he knows nothing. And so this humility behind the box of unknowns, let me explain it this way. I think this is Socrates. I want you to imagine a giant box out in the space. And that box represents all knowledge, everything that could be known. And then imagine a tiny circle within that box. That's what you know. And the edge of that circle is what's known as the unknown unknowns, what you know you don't know. It's an uncomfortable piece of the circle because you know you don't know it and you don't quite have it. Medical students have a very acute sense of that, right? What happens as you get older is that the circle gets bigger, and therefore the surface area of what you know you don't know gets bigger. And so having the humility to know that big old box is out there, that you didn't, that circle didn't become the square, the big box, I think is a really important thing to do as a leader. And I've certainly felt that because all that I just said today, I have no illusions that I can see every normalized deviance thing that I have. One of the things that has been happening the last 10 years, I think, has been sort of this realization of our identities. So I'm a white male in my 50s. Mm-hmm. When I walk in a room, something happens because of that. People make assumptions. I act certain ways. And it's been humbling to see that it reflected back in ways that I didn't know before. So I think if you're going to be a leader, you just have to be open to the fact that the way you are might have effects that you didn't anticipate. They might not always be good. If you can be open to that, then you can see to look for the harms that you might be causing, and then you have a chance of not doing that. But it's related to this concept that of the unknown unknown part of normalized deviance, where silence is unanimity, where silence is it doesn't exist kind mm-hmm. of thing. I just want to reflect, I'm looking at your faces. I feel like an old person. I just threw down that old guy wisdom, and I don't know, what does a young person think when you hear things like this from an old guy?
Yeah, no, I kind of latched on to talk about identity and how that influences, you know, how people see you and how you walk in a room and how people react, and the fact that, you know, as like with age comes expertise and like higher positions and more responsibility, and more responsibility comes how people see you differently and how people are more or less likely to be completely honest with you. And, you know, from a student perspective, how do I have confidence that, or, you know, I guess I need to assume that the people who are facilitating my learning, if you will, are open to feedback and not going to hold it against me. And I think that's a really important piece of, you know, what I took away today.
And yeah, and to go back to the identity as well, I think it's very important in this conversation. And also, I appreciate that it's made its way into healthcare, and we are starting to kind of recognize these things in ourselves and others, the impact they have on each other. Because I think that, like you said, like our generation has kind of, I don't know if it's led the conversation, but amplified with technology and things that we've talked about, and like TikTok and Twitter. So it's refreshing to hear its impact farther than our generation as well.
To return to normalized deviance, what you described was making the problem visible. So If I can't see how I act is influencing you in negative ways, then I can't see it. If you show it to me, then I might have a chance to making it better. And then, of course, the sentinel events are all the bad harms that come from discrimination or gaps in whatever between people, the lack of equity. That's all in that space. So you're watching that happen in real time. It's kind of cool.
And then to change the subject a little bit, but we talked about how with normalized deviance, there's always a like negative outcome or negative impact. And that's kind of how it works. Is there ever a world where normalized deviance is not a negative thing? Or is that just already inherently within the definition, I guess?
Yeah, I think the word deviant sort of says that that's not positive outcomes. I guess if you have something that's working well and creating benefit, that's not normalized deviance. That may be humans organizing together, like, but I don't think you would call that positive. If it's deviant, it's bad. If it's producing good outcomes, I wouldn't call it deviant.
Okay. Yeah, because I guess in psychiatry, they create space for us to kind of share some of our experiences third year, and just kind of comes to mind the idea of compartmentalization and how a lot of people use that in medicine in order to kind of keep doing their job. But if you tell, like going back to the example, if you called up your parent and told them that XYZ happened today, and then we turned around and maybe an obstetrics, you delivered a baby and then you turned around and one of the babies didn't make it, and then you turned around and another baby did, like, and just having to move so quickly between those scenarios, while I think that in one sense it might be deviant, because I think like someone outside of healthcare, let's say, would be like, oh my gosh, that's crazy, I can't believe you were able to do that, or you did that and you didn't have the time or spent time with the mom who lost a child, whereas someone else might look at that and say that's just necessary in order to keep doing your job, which might still be deviant. There are some negative outcomes. I guess that's kind of the space that question comes from.
Yeah, this is a debate that we have ongoing now. There was a New England Journal article, one of my favorite articles of all time, and that was a recent article by Lisa Rosenbaum, I think her name was. This is the debate we're having. How much stress is needed for you to live? There's this concept of to thrive. It's this concept called eustress, which is, I need to put a little pressure on you. In the zone of proximal development, there's a little pressure. I think my group has been thinking about it. Where it has to be hard. Being a physician is hard. If it was easy, a lot of more people would do it and you would get paid less. It's a very difficult thing to know so much, to be under the pressure. I think as educators, what we have to be careful of is where are the necessary difficulties and necessary places where it's hard or difficult, and where are the unnecessary things that are not helpful and are harmful. And that's nuanced. I don't have the quick answer. I'd write that paper if I knew it. Let me tell you a story that helps me think about this. I'm an internist. I think in System 2 thinking a lot. You know, typically you're in System 1, but I like to slow down and think about the 15th differential diagnosis, and I don't like a lot of acute problems. Like, if someone's dying this minute, that's not me. Some people who are intensivists, they like that. But that's not me. I was at a conference once when a vascular surgeon was talking, and he was showing his wares, and he was describing a case in which he was doing a angioplasty on a carotid artery. And because he was with confidence, I'll say, he invited the patient's daughter to come watch him do the thing. And that patient's daughter was a healthcare provider. So this is a high stress moment. You're sticking a catheter in someone's artery, trying to clean it out, while somebody who knows what's going on is sitting right there. And what happened was, while he was doing it, he dissected the artery and the person stroked out right there. And he's got 3 minutes to fix this problem or permanent damage. Well, he's showing this off, so he obviously fixed it. And at the end of the conference, I asked him, when you were standing there with this healthcare provider daughter watching you stroke out her mom and having to fix it, how did you know you could do that? And he said, and I'll quote, every surgeon asked themselves that question. He didn't answer the question, but that's how he asked it. And I thought, huh, the fires that he's forged under are going to be different than the fires that I would be forged under for my job. And so I have to have some humility there that whatever assumptions I make about the things I know best might be different for this person. So I think in every world that you end up in, you're going to have to figure that out. I can't tell an OBGYN what pressures you need to face in order to be great at your job. You all have to figure that out. Just don't have the pressures that are unnecessary. Figure that out. That's what we all should be doing. Easy to say, hard to do.
Well, thank you, Dr. Worm. Is there any other like final words of advice or reflections that you have on the topic that you'd like to share with us?
Stay humble. I don't have more than that.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.